Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and we have some very special interviews coming up today. We're going to start with Betty Duramis, who is a veteran and award-winning journalist. She was a Pulitzer Prize-winning Jury's Pick and finalist. She's written books about American history, for African-American history, for Essence, Time Life, North Star Journal, Black World. She's a former editorial writer and columnist of the Detroit News. She's written for Detroit Free Press, Michigan Chronicle, and BBC. And here on this Valentine's Day, we're going to talk about her book, Forbidden Fruit, Love Stories from the Underground Railroad, that I found buried in a bookstore in Annapolis a couple of weeks back, or I should say, be more clearly, my wife found it, and not me, but we took it, and we fell in love with this book immediately, and we are lucky enough to have Betty Duramis join us here on this day. And Betty Duramis, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Well, thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
This is a very important book, and it's not just, you know, when I tell people the title, they all gasp, in a good way.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was wondering why are they gasping? Because it's an unusual concept, probably.
Yes, because it's the beginning of a process of kind of nuancing and layering the lives of people who are slaves in America, and it's because it's unleashing a history that is so much more complex than we realize.
It's like you thought there were four roads on the highway, and there's a fifth one over here, and you suddenly realize there's different kinds of vehicles over in that road. You know, they're into something altogether different, and it's the exact opposite of the story that you usually told, also about escapes on the Underground Railroad. So I was trying to turn a lot of different things around, you know.
Yeah, and I think it's also what you get from this book, before we get into some of the specifics, is the huge numbers of people that were involved, the absolute dangers of people involved in the Underground Railroad. But how many people who were enslaved in this country really struggled for their freedom?
Well, I always say, people say, when did resistance to enslavement begin? It began the moment the institution began.
Right.
You know? So from the very first, you had people who were rebelling. And, of course, there's all kinds of ways to rebel. It can be in a very small way. It can be in a very large way. It can be a man or woman running away from the farm or the plantation with no intentions of making it out of there, just wanting a break.
Right.
there were people who did that in an almost ritualistic way. At certain times, they would take off, you know, just for a breather, knowing they were going to be brought back. You know, at the time of the Emancipation or the 13th Amendment, there were an estimated 4 million enslaved people in the United States. So that means there were 4 million stories.
Right.
You know, there was no one stereotype that covers them all. I just got swept up in this story, and I was surprised myself with some of the things I found.
And a lot of the stories took place in where you live, in Michigan. There's a whole lot about Michigan, and obviously in the Canadian-Michigan border was where a lot took place. But a lot of it does take place in that area.
Well, actually, I think there are more Virginia stories than anything else, because there was more slavery in Virginia, I think, than almost anywhere else. A lot of people ended up passing through Michigan because of the Detroit River, which, you know, is right across from Canada. So for a lot of people, Michigan was the last stop on either an assisted underground railroad or a self-generated underground railroad or whatever you want to call it. But a lot of states are covered. It's not just only Michigan. Like I said, Michigan often comes in at the end of the trail.
Let's begin with a couple of these stories to kind of flesh this out for our listeners here, listening to this conversation, because they're all so different. And one of the things I love about the way you write this is the in-depth individual portraits of human lives, and not just kind of a broad mass.
Yeah, I try to get the details, because that's the only way you can really hit people in the heart. You know, just telling the story isn't enough. They have to be able to smell the story. They need to know what people ate. They need to know what they took on their journeys and who they encountered along the way. I think what helped me capture a lot of the flavor was finding descendants of some of the people I wrote about.
Right.
That's the journalist in me. So I was trying to do two things at once. I was trying to be a journalist and get the story you know, go to the places that where some of these people came from, find descendants and all of that. But at the same time, of course, I had to do, you know, the census data and all the kinds of proof that you need to anchor these stories in reality. So I'm wearing one hat one day and another hat the next day. It was a thrilling ride, though. I felt like I was on the Underground Railroad at some point.
I was about to ask you that, because you get consumed in that like an actor gets consumed in a part.
I had never thought of it like that, but I just met some wonderful people. And I'm going to tell you something about doing research in small towns. It's totally different than going to the Smithsonian or the New York Library. Not that I didn't go to those places, and not that they aren't important. But when you go to places people have not heard of, or in some cases that are not on the map at all, people are so thrilled that you stop by. They're so thrilled that you find something connected to them important. I had people actually open up libraries and museums for me. You know, in a lot of places, museums aren't open all year round.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes I would show up when they weren't, you know, during their downtime. And once I would explain what I was looking for, people would actually open up the museum and find whatever I was looking for. Went to Greenlawn, New York, and had told some people I was coming, the Historical Society. They went and got a descendant of the man that I was researching, made sure she was in the library.
Hmm.
This was Samuel Balton.
Well, Samuel Balton's story, yes, right.
That's the last story in the book. He's the guy who wound up fighting in the Civil War, and during the midst of the war, sneaking through Confederate lines so that he could go home and check on his wife.
Rebecca.
Rebecca. Oh, my goodness. I got another. This is good. You can back me up. He went home to see Rebecca Ann, I believe her name
right.
was. And the Confederates stopped him on the way. And, you know, he was in a great deal of danger because they could have shot him on the spot and probably intended to. But the right words to make them not stop doing that just leapt to his lips. He just knew exactly what to say at the right period in time, and it didn't kill him. And he lived through the war, and after the war, he became a builder. He was not an educated man, but he got into trades, and he, I guess, was supervising building teams, and they were selling them to rich folks. Anyway, in the place where he died, which is Greenlawn, New York, at the time I visited, there were still four or five of the houses that he built or mm-hmm. supervised the building of were still standing. And one of them was living one of his direct descendants.
In the house.
In the house. In the house. The people at the museum brought her to the museum for me to interview. She had to be somewhere in her 90s, and she was just as sharp as she could be. Green suit. She had on a hat with a curved feather on the side of it. I mean, she was too sharp, okay? And can you imagine how I felt after, you know, reading Balton's pension files and every little scrap of anything I could find about him, and here's somebody, his blood, you know, the carrier of his dreams, talking to me. I believe they had his sword in there, too.
Had his sword in the house?
No, in the museum.
In the museum.
Yeah, I believe they had his Civil War sword. So it wasn't like you just picking up the phone and talking to somebody, or even sitting down in a, you know, in a library having an interview. You know, by going to the scene, as I did in some cases, it's like you really put yourself into the story. You really got, in a literal way, all the way in there. Now, another story that's in there has to do with, this is Michigan all the way, the fact that the Upper Peninsula of
yes.
Michigan. I'm sure you remember that one.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to the Upper Peninsula, and I rode a dog sled in February. I wish I had a picture of me and those Huskies. Just to sort of get myself in the mood for what it was like for these people from the South, because in, like between 1850 and 1860, you had this jump in black folks way up there in the Upper Peninsula, which was a rare thing even today. So I rode on the dog sled and had that whole experience just to try to envision what it was like to be there in a totally foreign environment, but still experiencing freedom.
That chapter, I mean, it's a pretty amazing story, and I think that's part of this thing that people don't realize all of what people went through to survive, to get to that place, to get to the place of freedom, and how many tens of thousands actually did it and made it through. And you tell the stories of these very specific people, and that this is the chapter you're talking about, the footprints in the snow. And I just, it's amazing to keep going north to make sure that you were going to stay free.
Well, I tell you, slave catchers were pretty vigilant, but it wasn't likely they were going to follow you to the Upper Peninsula. Especially in winter. And that just meant everything to people. It was a new life. It was a chance to find out who you really were. As an enslaved person, how could you know who you really were? Samuel Boughton would not have known he had the capacity to build houses.
Right.
You know, if he had not run away. And he never claimed that he was mistreated. He never claimed he was beaten or any of the things that did indeed happen to some people. It was fairly tranquil, but he didn't know who he was, but he knew he wanted to be something else. And just that alone was enough to motivate some people.
And people who were tortured. I mean, when you write about James Smith, a man who went through, a horrendous torture.
That is one of the most incomprehensible stories in the thing, that a man would be beaten.
Branded,
and separated from his family and subjected to all kinds of indignities because he was a Christian and expressed that openly. On the plantation where he worked, this was not something the owner wanted. He didn't want people to be devoted to any creed or belief. He didn't want them to become self-important as a result of being a part of something other than, you know, working on the land or whatever. He seemed to feel that James Smith was stepping out of his place by wanting to be a vocal Christian. And the fact that Smith wouldn't, despite all the tortures and beatings and everything he went through, he wouldn't stop.
Right. There's one line in there that really, you have so many things like this in this book, that little pieces like this that really strike people as I read, I think. We talk about the town they created, that they built, in the village that they built, and you have a line here that I have just to read. It just says, "Tiger lilies were among their favorite plants." They're talking about the former slaves of the refugees. "Perhaps because they, like these black settlers, loved the full sun and could flourish in almost any soil."
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I went to that village. I went to that place to try to feel what they felt.
In that chapter, you also kind of talk a lot, as you do much through this book, was the dangers of the Underground Railroad and how it was such a minority in America doing it, but what a powerful force and presence they had and the real dangers of people who were involved in it. I mean, the lives were on the line.
Yes, indeed. They were risking a fine. They were risking being ostracized. It was a crime to ignore or refuse to help authorities catch a runaway slave.
Right.
This was a bill that backfired on the people who lobbied for it. They thought it would, because it was so stringent and because the rules were so onerous, that it would discourage anybody from even escaping from enslavement. But what it did was revolutionized, if you will, more of the white population, because I think a lot of white people didn't care one way or the other. You know, they didn't want to be involved. But the fugitive slave law involved them.
Mm-hmm.
It said, if this is going on and you don't join in it, if you don't help the marshal or the deputy or whoever capture this enslaved person, then we can fine you. And we can punish you for not helping. And this changed a lot of people. I mean, they began thinking, well, this is not just their problem or somebody else's problem. I am in this. I think a lot of people had to, you know, began making choices since that kind of choice had already been made for them. It's just interesting how all these different forces play off against each other. It's a very complicated story, but we've made it simple.
Much too simple. That's why I'm glad that you wrote the book that you wrote here, Forbidden Fruit, because it gives us the complexity, putting us in that time and that place, because you can feel it through your words about what was going on, who these people were, what they looked like, what they felt like, the words they must have used. I mean, let's talk about kind of the stories. I mean, one of the first stories you open up with here is Joseph Antoine, who came here from Cuba.
Yes.
So this is a real romantic love tale.
This is a real romantic love tale. He had been enslaved in Cuba, and then he had been freed. We don't know why he decided to spend his freedom in Virginia.
It'd be interesting to know why he went to Virginia, but yes, right.
We don't know why the poor man, what led him to do that. He did fall in love with a woman. Unfortunately, her name has been lost to history. You know, I don't know what she was called. I don't know what she looked like. I think in the book, I say she looked like home.
Yes.
She looked like home to Joseph Antoine. When she was in danger of being sold away from him, he allowed himself to be re-enslaved in effect. I guess he actually became an indentured servant, which was a temporary form of enslavement. And, of course, her owner lied to him. He thought it was for a certain period, and it was double that period. It's one of those stories that don't end well. I need to make the point that although all these stories are about people striving to be together, people defeating the system, people trying to practice love in a time of oppression, not all of them succeeded. Some did.
And some didn't.
Yeah, some did have a happy ending. Some had a less than happy ending. The thing that unifies them is that they were all trying to be together. Joseph Antoine was one of those who was trying but failed. Teach us an important lesson on the way in terms of what high esteem these people held, the concept of marriage, which they were really forbidden to have a legal marriage, and so, of course, that was what they most wanted.
When you describe her, I love the way you describe what she might have looked like. You said she was a slave owned by a man named John Purcell, now in West Virginia, where they were living. Antoine married her, or had passed for marriage, in American Slave Society. Her name is not known, as you said, and no pictures of her Antoine survive. Maybe she was a black beauty with the kind of high-riding hips that could support a bundle or rock a baby, Africa oozing from every pore. Or maybe she was a pale woman, with slant to her eyes and a whisper of silk and cinnamon in her hair. Perhaps Antoine just looked into her eyes, the color of morning coffee, and saw something that told him that in this far-off place called Virginia, he managed to find home. That's the kind of stuff you tell us.
Wow, that sounds good. Did I write that?
You did write that.
I'm in trance. You got me on the edge of my seat. I was a writing son of a gun, probably
yes.
Under the spell of these people.
Well, I think
I do believe they took possession of me.
I think that may be true, because you also describe the law. Off of the book, you describe the laws and what life was like because these certain laws were passed in Virginia and other states and what that meant. I mean, you gave us historical context in all these stories.
Well, it actually is a history book, although I try very hard to disguise that. I'm sure there were some people who bought it thinking it was something other than a history book. If they didn't
really?
Read the introduction. I mean, Forbidden Fruit science sounds kind of racy, doesn't it?
It does. I like the title.
Yeah, you know. So, I mean, we got to do what we got to do.
That's right.
In this society, you know, we got a lot of writers have a lot of competition out here. You know, this is not the Real Housewives or whatever it is people are watching. So you got to dress it up a little bit.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to Common Core, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's one word, MarylandEducators.org. Or you can go to SteinerShow.org and click on the Maryland State Education Association's banner.
My friends, you know me today.
I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. You know, this Valentine's Day, we're going to talk about forbidden fruit, love stories from the Underground Railroad with Betty Duramus, who is a veteran and award-winning journalist. She was a Pulitzer Prize-winning Jury's Pick and finalist. She's written books about American history, for African American history, for Essence and Time Life, North Star Journal, Black World. She's a former editorial writer and columnist for the Detroit News. She's written for Detroit Free Press, Michigan Chronicle, and the BBC.
My favorite story is A Woman on John Little's Back.
Oh, yes.
I used to not be able to read this when I would do book signings because I would cry. What? I would always cry. Because it's just so touching to me that this woman who was so fragile, she couldn't even stand to be in the sun, and yet this man who loved her was running away with her and did everything he could to make that happen. I mean, this is one of those, you would think this would be a story with an unhappy ending, but actually it ends happily, but only because at one point he puts her on his back, carries her for a while, jumps over a fence with her on his back, then has her riding a log in the river, and he's swimming alongside the log and paddling to keep her afloat. Can you imagine that?
And it's in his words, too, because he told the story that Benjamin Drew.
Yeah, I used a lot of his own language because it was available, and that's very moving as well. But I could just see these people, this fragile, ill woman, and this man who just put his strong arms around her and did everything he could.
He was, I mean, when I read his words,
yeah,
they just completely grabbed me. I mean, he talking about, I mean, this the love was so deep, and he wanted to get to freedom, and they made it to the wilderness of Canada. I mean, that was just, that is one of my favorite stories, too, because a lot of it was in his words. It was very powerful.
Eliza women
and John.
Used to ask me when I would read that, do we know where his DNA is stored? Can we replicate this guy?
But, you know, one of the things you feel from this book is that there are a lot of people like that in this book. You know, I mean, maybe they didn't do exactly what he did. But, you know, even when you tell the story of the Blackburns.
Oh, yeah.
These people stood up. Entire communities stood up.
Oh, I love the Blackburn story, Thornton and Rutha.
Yes.
She was Rutha when she was in Detroit, and she became Lucy.
Right.
When she escaped, which was common because you didn't want to make it any easier than necessary for anybody to track you down. But what I liked about Thornton and Rutha is that they were just up front. They weren't hiding. They weren't running. They got on a ship and sailed down the river because of the way they carried themselves. And apparently Rutha was a beautiful woman, and she was wearing black silk or satin, and she was swishing around in the black dress.
I mean, flaunting it.
You know, and Thornton he apparently was a very proud walking, good looking guy, and nobody took them for enslaved people. They just took them at face value, let them on the ship, and they sailed off to freedom. I'm like, my kind of folks. Don't hide, don't run. just have soap. Just ooze so much confidence and charm that people will. You can define yourself for people. I just love that idea. And yes, that was a Detroit story. And when the slave catchers showed up to take them back to Kentucky, a well-planned uprising, took place, including a deception, some woman visiting Rutha in jail and changing clothes with her. And allowing Rutha to escape across the river to Canada. I mean, a well-orchestrated, well-thought-out plan so that it didn't happen. It didn't happen. They were able to get to Canada and remain free because Canada would not send them back. That is indeed a very uplifting story and one that ends very happily.
Yeah, they remained anti-slavery activists. They were involved. They had their places burned down, but they kept starting new things. They didn't stop.
Yeah, and they had an impression on the town, on Detroit, even after they left, because the people who were involved in plotting their escape became a force, a civil rights force. A number of them started churches. Their lives had consequences that kept reverberating. You know, it was not just it happened and it was over. It had long tendrils.
It did. That to me, that's a story that really grabbed me as I was reading it, and how they kind of just never gave up, and you talk about how the kind of you ended that in today's world.
Yeah. Well, yeah, yeah. Because landmarks mentioned in that story are still standing.
Second Baptist Church.
Yeah, Second Baptist Church is still standing. The jail is now a library.
And one of the things you didn't hear that it was interesting. We had this conversation earlier in the week with a woman who wrote this book, and one of about the slave world, the Underground Railroad in southern Indiana, Ohio, and Illinois, and the geography of resistance. And one of the things that she pulled out in that book, that you're doing the same thing in this book, that despite some of the things that Frederick Douglass wrote, you writing about the power of the black churches and what they did do as part of the Underground Railroad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the AME Church was very, very active.
And these Baptist churches people founded, they were part of that struggle.
Yeah, they were a part of the struggle. Sometimes the only refuge, most definitely that was a part of the struggle. And black people were part of the struggle. I think in a lot of the traditional history books that were written in an earlier time, you get the impression that all the abolitionists were white,
exactly.
Be blunt about it.
Right.
But if you think about it, that doesn't make sense. If you're running away from enslavement, you're going to first go to the people who look like you or the people you encounter close to home. You know, by the time you get to an organized Underground Railroad, you've traveled usually a long distance, and you've traveled a lot of that distance on your own. You see what I'm saying?
No, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, these are courageous people. Young people need to hear these stories to hear what people actually went through and how they persevered. I mean, you told us another story. Let's talk about Isaac and Lucy Berry.
That was the original story. That was the story that got me into this whole thing. That was one of my interracial stories,
right.
which again is an unknown thing. The book is mostly about African American people, but there were mixed couples during the enslavement era who wanted to get married, believe it or not. Isaac and Lucy Berry was the first story I heard of that kind. And it was just a passing thing. Someone I worked with, I guess, had attended one of their reunions. The descendants of Isaac and Lucy Berry up in the middle part of Michigan are part of a group of rural black folks who settled in Mecosta County. And they have an annual reunion to review their history, pass on their history, greet and, fellowship with each other. And this person who told me the story apparently had attended one of these reunions. And he was very casual. He just said, "You really ought to go up there and talk to those people. You'll be surprised." That's all he said. Eventually, curiosity got the better of me, and I went up to Mecosta County. I didn't know who I was looking for, didn't know where to find anybody, so I went to the library.
Mm-hmm.
I told the librarian the story, and she says, "Oh, yeah, tell her you want to talk to her. If she wants to talk to you, she'll call you back." And Marie did call me. Marie was the, unfortunately, she's passed away since then, but Marie was the granddaughter of Isaac and Lucy Berry. She was still living. All these people lived to be in their 90s and hundreds. Marie was still living. She said if I would come back and come to her house, she'd tell me all she knew. I go there thinking I'm just going to be talking to this one nice little old lady, get a little history. I knock on the door. She opens it. There's 34 people in there, eating and enjoying themselves, and they're all descendants.
Amazing.
They're all descendants of either Isaac and Lucy or some of the other runaways and what have you that settled in the same area. And that was just fascinating to me because, like I said, I had never thought of the only interracial relations you hear about in connection with slavery are, unfortunately, the rape of black women. I had never heard of consensual relationships going on between blacks and whites leading to marriage during the slavery era.
And it happened.
And it happened. It happened more than once.
When I was reading your book, the woman I'm about to mention I'm no longer married to, but we were married for a long time, and her family, that was part of her family story. And your book, and maybe the other things I'm reading, made me realize it wasn't an anomaly.
Ah.
And in Virginia, he was a slave master. She was what people called an octoroon slave.
Yes.
And before the Civil War ended, they were in love. They fled to the mountains to marry and raise seven daughters.
Uh-huh.
Who ended up in Washington, D.C. Four stayed black, three passed were white and left.
Yeah, a number of my friends and acquaintances have come forth since I opened the door, have come forth and told me that this happened in their families. But they hadn't talked about it.
Right.
You know, I guess there was no vehicle through which to talk about that because it would seem so strange in the context of what we think of as history. You know, but it happened a lot more often than people thought. Isaac Berry escaped from Missouri, not only because he wanted to be with Lucy, but because his owner was a riverboat gambler, and he was about to sell Isaac to pay his debts. So he took off. I think it took him 3 months to reach Michigan. Meanwhile, Lucy's been sent to finishing school in Illinois, and when she gets there, she takes what's supposed to be her tuition money and catches another train to Detroit, because apparently they had this plan where they were going to meet. I don't know if they were supposed to meet in Detroit or across the river in Canada, but they were both heading in the same direction against what I would imagine were pretty long odds, because they weren't traveling together. They did indeed meet, marry, live in Canada, and after the war moved to Mecosta County, Michigan, where, as I said, they still have descendants. I'm abbreviating the story because there were a lot of dramatic things that happened along the way. But that was my, like I said, that was my first introduction to this whole world. That was what hooked me on writing this.
That's
book.
Interesting. That's where you start. Because there are a couple of interracial romances in here that you touch on, like Molly Walsh and Banaka. That was a great way of introducing the world to who Benjamin Banneker was and where he came from.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, and I met quite a few members of that family. Working on this book has made me a part of a network of people who have descendants, whose descendants are mentioned in the book. We're all on Facebook together. And
mm-hmm.
You know, and it's just expanded. I'm just trying to tell you, it's expanded my world in more than one way.
Well, I would imagine it has, and this whole book and idea can take on life of its own. We'd be remiss if we didn't talk, since I'm in Baltimore.
Okay.
We need to talk about Leah Green.
Well, that of course is one of the better known stories, because it was in William Still's book, The Underground Railroad.
Right.
Many of the stories in Forbidden Fruit have never actually been put together before in any kind of coherent form. At least I hope it's a coherent form.
No, it is a very coherent form, and I have not known almost any of these stories at all until I read your book.
Oh, okay. Well, Lear Green is one of the more well-known pieces, but I hope I did a good job, though, of bringing alive what it must have been like for an 18-year-old girl to spend 18 hours inside a sailor's chest being shipped like baggage from Baltimore to Philadelphia and then traveling from there to Elmira, New York. Just think what that experience would have been like. How frightening, how dangerous.
Yeah. No, and lucky thing that his mother was with her, let her out of the chest every once in a while to take
a
breath.
Yeah, that's what William Still says, that her mother-in-law-to-be managed to book passage on the ship that her, this is awful, I was going to say her coffin. Oh, my God. the chest.
Right.
It easily could have been. So yeah, that probably made all the difference, having her mother-in-law on the ship and being able to catch a breath of air. But still, I couldn't even imagine reenacting it.
No, you wrote in the book. You wrote about a man who attempted it.
Yeah. But I couldn't. I don't think I could even do that.
No,
I don't think I could even get inside a box like that. You know,
I'm too claustrophobic for that one. I don't think I could. Yeah. One never knows what they could do to get out of what they're in. But.
Well, that's true. What a true statement that is.
You know, I mean, given what people fleeing enslavement and understanding that, I actually have to make a trip down to 504 South Broadway, and they need to put a marker there.
They may have. At the time I wrote this, there was no marker, but there might be something in Baltimore there.
I'll have to
Baltimore
take,
now.
I'll take a look and let you know and let the world know. If not, we'll get one there. We'll make sure they put it up there because it needs to be there. There's another story I really want to touch on because there's so many. I could spend hours here just instantly going through each detail of this book. But there's an incredible story of the Sills who knew who they're descended from.
Oh, the Still family?
Yes.
It's not clear if they had their genealogy absolutely correct. But the point is they had a sense of who they were. And they had a name and a story that had been passed down. And that made them different people. You know, they weren't as lost or severed from the past to the degree that other people were. And I don't think people understand what a huge difference that makes in your psyche to have a sense of continuity in your lives. They still have family reunions every year. In fact, when I started researching the story, I went to one Still family reunion in Philadelphia. I went to another Still family reunion in Lawnside, New Jersey, where I was able to talk to a direct descendant. I mean, they just go to the nth degree celebrating who they are and bringing all that alive for other generations, which is, you know, what I hope to some small degree that I've managed to do because in this culture, in this hard-edge culture we're living now, we definitely need some different kinds of heroes.
And, you know, we do, and you're giving them to us. I mean, this is why I think these things are important, because they give us heroes that people need to see and feel that they don't have. And, you know, I mean, when you write things, I'm going to go back to this one piece about we talked about a moment ago, about Molly Walsh and Mary Jane and others. And you just this one paragraph, let me read it to you, because it gets us. This is the sense you give people of what the contradictions were like in that society. You wrote, "What was a black female cook named Mary Jane thinking when she tried to elope with a white gentleman aboard a steamboat in 1856, protected by nothing but a veil? And why were there no laws shielding black women from owners who raped them and produced new slaves, but tons of laws designed to keep white women from having mulatto children who they would eventually be free? The answer to the last question is obvious. Planters lost money when white women produced free children and made money when they impregnated their own slaves. But what drove people like John and Jane Walls to risk so much for an uncertain future?" It was this combination, this power of personal love and the desire for freedom, and how they met.
Yeah, the intersection at which they came together, and it also brings out a lot of what people think was simple racial prejudice was motivated initially by the desire to make more money. You know, there was a point in our history very, very early when people who became enslaved were not yet enslaved. They were indentured also. And the white and black indentured servants, I don't think, were having a problem with each other, especially the Irish women. But because it went against the financial interests of the people, of the slave owners, the net tightened. All kinds of things became against the law. Enslavement became a lifetime thing. All these things can only be understood in the context of profits, you know.
Right.
Then after you enshrine a way of making more money, then you surround it with all kinds of mythology and racism and this and that and the other. But initially, it was about profit.
That you're right. I mean, that was this whole system. It was underlying our entire capitalist world.
Yeah, but I mean, it was disguised, you know, in so many different ways. oh, it was a good thing to bring the enslaved people here because they would have the benefits of religion. They deserved to be enslaved because of this. They inherited this. The sin of Ham, the curse of Ham. I mean, everything except what it really was about. You know what I'm saying?
No, I know exactly what you're saying.
Yeah.
I know exactly what you're saying.
Yeah.
There's a couple of things before we go I wanted to kind of talk about, just because you, in these great love stories you tell, and they're incredible love stories of men and women who stood together and built businesses and lives together once they got to freedom, and cab companies, anything they did to make life so they could take care of their families, the money they made. I mean, this kind of spirit that embodied these people in love from the Underground Railroad, that embodied the refugees from slavery. I mean, they were brave, bold people. I mean, they were adventurers, pioneers. They were fearless to find freedom, and building a new life around it, really building a life.
Yeah.
I mean, that's part of what you give us in this book, I think.
Well, yeah, yeah. I try to follow them out into the world they created, and I was happy to discover that quite a few of them left not just footprints in the snow, but footprints in the sand and footprints on the grass and everywhere else. It was a generation of change, of hardship, but it was creative hardship in the sense that people saw it as having a purpose. And that is a great breeding ground for achievement.
Now, I was just looking at a photo here from the Civil Rights Movement of a young black couple in the face of a white mob, I assume integrating a school. It says, be careful with each other so you can be dangerous together.
Wow.
Yeah. So I wonder what you think your stories have to teach us about love and resistance today.
It has to teach us about the strength of love. I mean, if people could survive one of the worst periods, one of the most oppressive periods in history, by armoring themselves with love, I just hope we haven't forgotten that. I just hope we know how powerful we were standing together, how powerful we were believing so deeply in family, to the extent that quite a few people, and I have written a second book in which I talk about some other kinds of stories about the Underground Railroad. There were numerous people who went back, even after they had escaped, even after their mates had escaped, they would go back to get nephews, go back to get sisters and brothers and mothers and kin. I just want to remind people that extended family is not just a phrase. It's not just a concept you throw around when you're writing a paper about a certain period in history. It's real. It's living. It's burning. It's powerful.
What you're saying is important, because people now want to look at, you know, when you write this one piece where you say Joseph Antoine wouldn't have understood Dangerfield, newbies, and Henry Bibbs' desperate attempts to rescue their wives and children, would have understood, I mean to say.
Would have understood.
He probably wouldn't have understood why between 1970 and 1990 the proportion of black women married by age 24 plunged from 56 to 23% as more black men shambled to prison, died young, or found it difficult to imagine making enough money to support a family. And I think about what you were just saying, because what people want to give us is that the legacy of slavery was about the destruction of love and family, but what you're giving us is that the resistance to slavery gave people the legacy of love and family.
Yeah, it gave all the more reason to cherish love and family.
Right.
Because it was how we got over, as the song said, you know. So I think people sort of, it is true that, you know, I'm not going to deny that any number of black families were destroyed during this enslavement.
Oh, no, absolutely,
era.
Right.
But the idea of the black family, the idea of loving and cherishing, was not destroyed. See, that's the contradiction. You know, James Smith may have had to go through hell to find his wife, but he never stopped wanting to find her. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
The concept was strong. And after emancipation, there was a period when the black marriage rate pretty much was the same as the white marriage rate. That began changing in the 40s and the 50s for reasons we're not going to even go into.
Right.
Because that's a show.
Unto itself.
Unto itself. But, it's more complicated than what we think, you know. And it's not that easy to totally destroy the human spirit either. Sometimes what you think is destroying it is actually giving it a way to return, you know.
And you're giving us that this way in this book. And I just want to thank you. Betty DeRamis has written this incredible book. We've just been talking about it. And Forbidden Fruit, Love Stories from the Underground Railroad. And Betty DeRamis, I appreciate you taking the time to listen to us today. And thank you so much.
Thank you so much for finding the book in, was it in the basement?
In the basement of the secondhand bookstore. My wife pulled it off the shelf and went, look what I found. And here we are.
Wonderful. So good talking to you.
You too.
All righty.
Thank you so much.
I can't sleep at night.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break.
Treat me right. He makes me feel so blue. I don't know what to do. Sometimes I said he'd die and then began to cry. He went away and never even said goodbye. There's a change in the ocean, change in the deep blue sea, my baby. I'll tell the world there ain't no change in me. My love for that man will always be. Now I've got the Harlem blues since my man went.